The basis for my research was my own background in 33 years in church-based ministry, in the interpretation of ancient texts, and training pastors in the tools of interpretation, what we call hermeneutics. The thing that got me into paleo contact was my reading of the Bible, going to the root meanings of keywords, and then finding the parallels in the ancient narratives from out of Sumeria, Babylonia, Arcadia, and Assyria. There's certainly an overlap between my findings and those of Zechariah Sitchin in the Mesopotamian cuneiform text. The function that Nibiru plays in those stories is as a star base. So we have the observers with their stations in the stars, and then we have a mothership or a star base, and it is Nibiru. Before we get into today's content, on behalf of the Fifth Kind TV, I want to say a big thank you to Surfshark for sponsoring today's content. Surfshark is a VPN that allows us all to become citizens of the world through online access. If you're like me, you'll enjoy watching online content from countries all around the world. But I live in Australia, and what I'm shown in internet searches will be different to what you're shown in Canada, America, the Philippines, Germany, the Netherlands, or wherever you're watching from. By using Surfshark, I'm able to access a world of online content and see all the things that you see and many other things beside. Surfshark enables us to become citizens of the world through online availability. Get fully protected. Follow the link in the description, sign up and use the promo code FIFTHKIND to receive an 85% discount. Plus, you'll get 4 months for free. Surfshark offers a 30-day money-back guarantee, so if you try it and you don't like it, you can easily cancel your subscription and receive a full refund. With Surfshark, you can swim under the radar in the sea of online content.
Hey, Paul. I love your Book of Enoch video I watched on the Fifth Kind. What are your thoughts on Zechariah Sitchin's theories that the Anunnaki came from the planet Nibiru and created humans to mine gold on Earth?
Thanks, John, for that question. Zechariah Sitchin is a person who I know about, but I've actually not probed his work. I've not read his books, and sometimes I horrify people when I say that, because I know that our thinking is very much adjacent to each other's. But when I wrote my first book of Paleo Contact, which was Escaping from Eden, the basis for my research was my own background in 33 years in church-based ministry, in the interpretation of ancient texts, and training pastors in the tools of interpretation, what we call hermeneutics. And so I was building my case for the idea that our ancestors had contact with other civilizations in the deep past, and that the memories of that contact are sewn into the stories of the Bible. Now, I was getting towards the end of putting that book together when I discovered Zechariah Sitchin. And on the one hand, I thought, oh, this is fantastic. I'm not the first person to connect these dots and to make the connection with other ancient narratives around the world. Should I stop and read up on Zechariah Sitchin before I continue? Or should I just follow my data and follow my logic? I decided to do the second, because I thought, if I stop and read up on Zechariah Sitchin, what's going to happen is my book is going to turn into a he said, she said kind of book. And I don't think that's very interesting. I think it would be more interesting for the reader if I show my data, apply my logic using the disciplines I've learned in my work, and then if I reach similar conclusions to Zechariah Sitchin, that's far more interesting. And people will say, hey, look, these guys came at this topic from entirely different start points, and they overlap. Maybe there's something going on here. I think that's more interesting. And yes, there's certainly an overlap between my findings and those of Zechariah Sitchin. Nibiru is a point where we don't totally overlap. Nibiru is a wandering planet. in Sitchin's work. I haven't really found the evidence for that in the Mesopotamian cuneiform texts. The function that Nibiru plays in those stories is as a star base, we could call it. So we have the observers with their stations in the stars, and then we have like a mothership or a star base, and it is Nibiru. That's the role it plays. The texts don't say what it is. They don't say it's a planet, for instance, or a rogue planet or a wandering planet or a planet on some much longer period. Those are conclusions that Zechariah Sitchin has reached, and he may have reached those through connecting Mesopotamian story with other stories from other parts of the world. But it's not a conclusion I've reached. I'm not decided that Nibiru was a planet, but I would say it was some kind of a star base.
Thanks, Paul. I love your videos on the fifth kind. What do you make of the research and work of Billy Carson and Stephen Greer, particularly their views on advanced technologies and the suppression of these technologies?
Well, I'm friends with Billy Carson, and I find that our work does overlap to a large degree. And I'm aware of the work of Dr. Greer, although I haven't probed it deeply. But I am in agreement with both that we are in a situation where there has been a suppression of technology, and for quite some time, and certainly since the Roswell incident of 1947, there has been an active program of reverse engineering. And I take seriously the claim of the former chief of space security for Israel, Professor Brigadier General Haim Meshed, that there have been collaborations going on, technology sharing. I think it's very possible that there is technology that is ours and has been ours for a long time that most of us don't know about. And I know that's a white rabbit that Dr. Greer has pursued. I think it's interesting, this language of collaboration, because you have to ask, well, what is it we can bring to that conversation if we're in communication with such advanced neighbors? And people have raised the question of whether what we're offering is biological data for them to study, that we are really just the observed and we're being drip-fed technology. What Haim Meshed suggested is that we are going to remain in the dark as to current contact until our scientists are able to replicate the technology they've been shown, that when we reach the point where we can master space-time with metamaterials, when we can create a little space-time bubble, which suddenly gives us access to the cosmos, that's when all the rules of the game change, and we will go from being the observed to being one of the community of spacefaring civilizations. This is what he said. It's also what the late Dr. Ed Mitchell argued as well. The problem is that we have incentivized non-disclosure of technology because military intelligence has delegated the work of the program, the reverse engineering program, to private corporations who are profit-driven and who have access to trillions of dollars of black budgets in their reverse engineering work. There is an incentive to revealing their finds as slowly as possible, because as long as they're doing that, they've got these massive budgets from year to year. And I think that might be a problem. That might be slowing the conversation down. But I think my optimism is that we're not the only ones in that conversation, and that collaboration does suggest some kind of tutelage going on, and that we have observers who are waiting for us to come to the party in that kind of way. But there's always a push and a pull with regard to the process of disclosure and the sharing of this technology. It's why I've written my book, The Invasion of Eden, to give people an idea of what the state of play is right now, and to understand that whether we're looking at the whether we're looking at the military intelligence community, or we're looking at government, or we're looking at corporations like Boeing and Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, Skunk Works. These are all communities of people, and they don't all think exactly the same thing. And so there will be powerful people who want more disclosure. And I think we've got Thomas Monheim, for instance, the Inspector General of the Intelligence Community, in a forward-leaning posture in terms of more disclosure. And then we've got others who want very much less. So there's always this push and pull of what's revealed and debunked, shared and not shared. And if you read The Invasion of Eden, I talk about how we can respond to that. It makes some people very weary and very skeptical and cynical. I think it's actually a time when we need to shine a lot of light on these processes and bring as much accountability to them as possible. The thing that got me into paleo contact and to making these discoveries in ancient narratives around the world was my reading of the Bible, going to the root meanings of keywords, and then finding the parallels in the ancient narratives from out of Sumeria, Babylonia, Arcadia, and Assyria. And on the 25th of August, I will be doing a workshop hosted by Forbidden Knowledge. I'll be joining Billy Carson, and we'll be providing tools to help people do that for themselves. People often ask, how can I get to these root meanings? And how can I begin to read the cuneiforms for myself so that when I get into conversation, I'm not just having to say, oh, well, Paul says this, or Billy says this, or this other researcher says this, so that I can say, well, I've looked at these texts and they say this. And so we'll be spending a number of hours together looking at these texts and providing the tools that will enable you to get into these stories, learn how to read them, and learn how to do the reframing that these stories throw up. That's happening on August the 25th. It's a ticket-only event, and it's being hosted by Forbidden Knowledge.
Do you see Christianity as a force for good or bad in world history? I feel that Christianity is very likely the reason we haven't annihilated ourselves. I also feel that Jesus had a connection beyond what we had back then or now.
Al or AI walls? Yes, that's a really loaded question. Has Christianity been a force for good or for bad through history? I think in a way it depends how you define Christianity. It's certainly a story of light and shade. I think if we look at the history of imperial religion, that's a pretty dark story, because imperial religion has been used to control the masses and to justify all kinds of atrocities, enslavements of people groups, invasions of other people's countries, all done in the name of a violent god. And if you've got a violent god, because you're reading the Elohim stories as God's stories, you can justify all kinds of violence as you go about extending your power and building your empire. So unfortunately, there's a lot of that. And when you look at the story of invasion, that's very brutal too, as in the past, invaders have sought to obliterate the indigenous story and indigenous priesthoods, indigenous memory of human origins, delete and replace it with a mainstream orthodoxy. And you think of the story of the obliteration of the Cathars, for instance, in medieval France, or the obliteration of the priesthoods of Central and South America during those conquests. It's a pretty sad story. However, Christianity is a tradition full of people. And again, it's a spectrum of people. And so you will have power brokers, you will have elites in it, but you'll also have grassroots people in it as well. And you'll have pioneers and social pioneers. And the history of Christianity is full of incredible leaps forward in the human story. It leaps forward even in science, leaps forward in our social behavior, in our political behavior. So one of my heroes, for instance, is Francisco Jimenez. And he was the priest, the Roman Catholic priest. He was a Dominican friar who went to the town of Chichicastenango in Guatemala and loved the people there so sincerely, was such a trustworthy person, that even though it was the authorities of his church that had sought to destroy anything remaining of the Mayan culture when the conquests were happening, he personally was entrusted with the ancient Quiché text, the ancient Mayan story, to translate into Spanish. He is the reason we know what the Popol Vuh said, and he helped to recover this non-Christian story of origins and bring it to the world. Another hero of mine is Robert Kirk, who, like me, was deeply into translating the Bible. Like me, he spent many years as a pastor in a local community, and he was a genuine priest and pastor. He listened to his people, and he began to recognize stories that didn't fit within the mainstream of secular thought or Christian theology. These were stories of a non-human presence in the locality, abduction experiences, and he started to reach the conclusion that the geopolitics of our whole planet is influenced by these beings who are not human, who have strings to pull when the elites make their decisions before they're influencing our visible structures of leadership. And he published that. So we've got really bold pieces of research and translation coming from people like that. The Cathars, who created the society that was so different to mainstream medieval society, that people looked on them and called them the good people. That's what the Cathars means, because they'd created a better society. All these things have sprung from Christianity. I think we can see some wonderful experiences of what people call revival. If you look at the story of the Franciscans, as people bought out of mainstream culture and found new ways of building community, similar things were done in the early days of the Wesleyan movement, the Quaker movement. It is as if it relates to the second half of the question, I think. There is something real that happens to people when they seek a connection with the divine, when they seek a connection with Source. And if you read the stories of revivals through history, that is what people are experiencing. So if you look at the story of the Welsh revival, for instance, at the beginning of the 20th century, what people were suddenly experiencing wasn't a renewal of Orthodox theology. It was a deep personal emotional experience where all of a sudden they were no longer in fear of the wrath of God. They were no longer in fear of hellfire. They had this energy and life and confidence within them that they had not known before. And it was so powerful and so effective in their lives, they actually got thrown out of churches for having it, just like the Wesleyans had been thrown out in their day. And so there is something very real that happens when people seek a divine connection. And often that comes from within religious traditions. And of course, not only within Christianity, because you can find these mystical experiences in cultures all around the world, whether it's coming from a religious start point or a shamanic start point. So I think really it's Christian history is both a treasure chest and a Pandora's box, and we have to read it in both those ways.
People talk about the law of attraction as a way of getting the things you want. Have you found anything like that in our ancient mythologies?
Kalea, I have not found it in many of our ancient narratives, but I do find a sort of foundation for it in Plato. Now, the law of attraction, that's the idea that you can influence the circumstances that you are going to experience through controlling your state of mind and your emotional state. So that if you can think and emote like a wealthy person, that you'll attract wealth, that kind of thing. And obviously the hope is that you can manipulate the laws of the cosmos in such a way that you can attract better circumstances. So that's the basic idea, if I've understood it correctly. And Plato actually does give some kind of a foundation to that way of thinking. What he says is that he believes we are all here to have experiences, that we we pre-exist this life as conscious beings, and then we have this material experience in order to have experiences and learn things, and specifically learn how to love. And he argues, I believe he's arguing from his own personal experience of a ceremony he went through in the Eleusinian sect. And it was a tea drinking ceremony with a psychoaffective tea that would induce a near-death experience. And on the basis of that, he argues that we will all have a better experience of this life if we can learn to live without fear and live more courageously. In fact, he says, if we can shuffle off all the heavier emotions, we will have a better human experience and then a better post-human experience, post-material experience. And by heavier emotions, he meant things like rage, fury, unforgiveness, fear, trauma, unfulfilled ambition. And he says, if we shake those off, we will have a better experience. And the implication is that if we are living our life in these heavier emotions, what people call these lower vibrations, then clearly we are going to, through our subconscious or through the laws of the cosmos, we're going to attract circumstances that will give us the opportunity to learn to shake them off. So if you're in an angry state, the universe is going to provide you with more reasons to be angry so that you can learn to overcome it. If we're in a fearful state, your subconscious might generate more fearful interpretations of life so that you have to learn to overcome it. It's really the implication of what Plato was saying, that once we've learned to shake these things off, live courageously, live compassionately, imaginatively, happily, that the universe will then provide us with more opportunities to do exactly that. And so I think the take home of Plato's teaching is we need to be very intentional about our mental and emotional state. I think if we're passive, if we go into our default, then the circumstances of life and what we're fed by the media will pull us into a bit of a funk. But if we're intentional, then we will want to learn to be positive, imaginative, creative, compassionate, loving. And that when we do that, we can expect more and more opportunities for that to come our way. So it's the idea that we learn to master these things and then they become our experience.
I really enjoyed your recent Fifth Kind documentary from the Van province in Turkey. In your travels with Matt LaCroix, did you find any solid evidence of previous civilizations, and if so, how old are they?
Thanks, Virgil, for that. It was a wonderful experience going to the Van province, and the reason I was particularly excited to go there is because of my field, which is ancestral story, world mythology, ancestral narratives, and there are so many vectors in that field that point to modern-day Turkey, the lands of ancient Armenia, and the Van province in particular as a really significant node in the human story. In the Bible, you've got the story of Noah that takes you to that region. And in my latest book, The Invasion of Eden, I argue that the story of Abraham begins there as well, adjacent to the Van province in modern-day Turkey. Classical writers, ancient Greek and Roman writers, point to that part of the world and say that's where the Iron Age began. And there is solid archaeological evidence for the beginning of the Iron Age happening there. There is archaeological evidence for the beginning of farming happening in that region as well. This was the evidence surfaced by Manfred Hoyne and the team from the University of Az in Norway and the Max Planck Institute at Karacadağ in 1998. They've made that discovery. It's home to one of the world's most ancient languages. If we read the Viking stories penned by Snorri Sturluson in the 1200s, he points, when he's talking about the Æsir from Asaland and their fortified community of Asgard, he points to ancient Armenia as well. He said Odin came from there. And it wasn't that he was reading all the Norse god stories as if they were all history. He didn't believe that Thor was history, for instance, but he believed Odin was and that his people came from there. So having read up on those, I knew that there were many reasons to be going to the Van province and asking the question, is there archaeological evidence to support these ancient claims? Snorri Sturluson points to linguistic evidence. I can point to narrative evidence. We can find archaeological evidence for Iron Age and farming. What else can we find? How far back does it go? Can we support the story of Noah and the idea that the human population on planet Earth was rebooted from that part of the world? Because that is the local law in that place as well. Alongside the Noah story, when you go to the lands of ancient Armenia, you'll hear about the people of Hike and the people of Haldi. And Hike was a near descendant of Japheth, one of the sons of Noah. So the local story says, yes, the reboot happened here. So we went to look at the archaeological remains at the sites of Çavuş Tepe, Kefkelesi, and Ioannis Kolesi, and we'll go back in October to look at those and a couple of others as well. And one of the questions we were asking is, how far back do the megalithic remains go? We know about the Urartu civilization who lived there in the first millennium BCE, and we have an idea of their stories and what they built and the sites that were their special holy and royal sites. But the question is, what was there before they built there? Because the Van province is a very, very fertile part of the world, even more fertile in the deep past. It's unlikely that the Urartians were the first people ever to live there. And it's unlikely they were the first people to build on those high places. So the question is, what was there before? What may have been built on top of in those places? And so when we go back in October, we're going to go back with geological expertise, archaeological expertise, with LIDAR. We're going to look below the surface of the ground to find out what is underneath the current structures and get our heads around how many building cultures we can identify in that place. So that's what we're going for the solid archaeological evidence. But I'm already there because of all these ancient narrative traditions. And if you read The Invasion of Eden, I bring some of these threads together and say we have every reason to look to that part of the world for an explanation of this bottleneck that is represented within our DNA record that says there was a point when Homo sapiens got reduced to a population of about 1,000. And so the question is, when was that and how and why did that happen?